Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from the wonderful, least corrupt country in the world, allegedly, New Zealand, the shining jewel of the South Pacific, where all race relations are born, and everybody gets along just dandy and swimmingly. My very special guests today are going to be forming a different format to the way the Vinnie Eastwood Show normally runs. It'll be pretty similar, but it'll be a little bit different. Is that we've got two people of opposing viewpoints on together. Normally I just have somebody on, they get to talk about whatever they want, and I act like their best friend. I'll still act like their best friend anyway, except they might not get along. So let's see how it happens. What have we got? Is it the red corner or the blue corner kind of thing? So in the blue corner we have John Ansell wearing the white trunks. And in the red corner for the mana party, we have Joe Trinder in the black undies. Welcome to the show, bro. And boys.
Hey. Hi.
Okay. Kia ora, Vinny.
So, this has come off the back of a recent interview on Māori television that many who have seen it have called shameful from both sides of the debate, more to the point. And I would like to offer this platform as, shall we say, a supplementary, somewhere you can actually have a real debate without being shouted over or shouted down, as I often see happen to people who are trying to explain their ideas, especially if those ideas are somewhat offensive. So, John, can you please explain to us from your experience how that interview on Māori television went, perhaps what went right and what went wrong?
Well, it went the normal way that interviews on Māori television go for me. I'm normally told there'll be one person up against me, and normally there's more on the day, and then the interviewer climbs into me. Well, this time it happened anyway. Last time it didn't. But it's quite good for me. I quite like the ambushes because it serves to show the moderate Māori people how one-eyed their radical cousins are. And in this case, we had a woman, Mihi Nairangi Forbes, who I presented evidence to that Alan Titford did not burn down his house. That's one of the offences that he's serving 24 years in prison for. On receipt of that evidence, her first priority was not to think, hey, a major injustice has been done. It was to demand that I apologise to the tribe, Te Rōroa, who were plausible suspects, but evidently, with this evidence, if you accept this evidence that Titford's wife's father burnt the house down to get her off the farm, where they were being menaced with death threats and stock shootings and all this by the local tribe. If you accept that evidence, that means that Te Roro is off the hook as well. Her main priority was that I apologise to Te Roro, not that, you know, maybe the state might like to apologise to Titford. So it's absolute shameful bias, and there was much yelling and screaming and so on. But basically, I think I put across most of the things I wanted to say. I didn't do it completely because I was being yelled at the whole time. But, it was just another example of bias from a racist station who liked to call me racist for proclaiming racial equality.
What are your thoughts on the interview and how it was conducted, the good and the bad sides of it?
I think Mihin and Angie Forbes could have conducted that interview a bit better. But as with most people that interview John, I think they just get really frustrated by some of the things that he says, that they get a bit, they tend to talk over the top of him and get frustrated, yeah.
Well, in that case, what happens in those kind of conversations, I used to do that to people when I'd shout out. It's either because I know I'm right or because I'm too afraid that they are.
Yeah. Could I come in here? Or
go for your life, son.
I think that the real reason people get frustrated with me is that I'm incredibly blunt in telling the truth. It's not very welcome in this country. I said at one point, when I get really sick of this idea that Maori are not are somehow disadvantaged by colonisation, when all the facts and figures show that they've been massively advantaged over where they were. And for my sins, I just come out with it, and I said, look, because Mihi said, oh, but what about our bad crime stats? And I sort of pointed out, you could barely hear me for all the yelling, but Maori were the most violent race on earth before the British set eyes on them. I mean, that much is absolutely clear. It doesn't give me a great thrill saying it. All of our cultures on earth, including mine, certainly had their moments of barbarity and depravity. But, you know, to say that Maori violence today is caused by the British, when it's only four generations since they were living in cannibalism, you know, the part descendants, that needs to be said. Sooner or later, that needs to be said, and I'm just saying it, and that's the thing that frustrates people, because it's true. A Maori woman, a cousin of Hone, Harawira, has told me that. She said, oh, but I can say that, but you can't. I said, well, I can, because someone has to point out the obvious truth of where this violence comes from. It doesn't come from the British.
Joe, your response?
Well, I do tend to disagree with that. One of the things that John always likes to point out is he goes straight for the throat when he's discriminating against Māoridom, is he goes straight for cannibalism. Well, there's been strong history of cannibalism actually in British history, and examples of that is one of the members of the royal family, King Charles, was actually a cannibal. he used to eat blood, and also during the Crusades, many Europeans resorted to British precisely resorted to cannibalism when they were invading some of the Middle East. And there's also been examples in World War II on the Eastern Front where the only food that was around was human flesh, and people were committing cannibalism in Europe as short as 50 years ago. But one of the things I think is quite funny about the cannibalism is Māori stopped probably cannibalism about 100 years. In Europe, they still do cannibalism in the 21st century. There's still people getting convicted for cannibalism. So we've given up. I mean,
well done.
You know.
But, you know, this was endemic. I mean, all Annex Sykes could say about that was, oh, there were the French cannibals, whoever they were. I mean, I know the French like a good feed, and I know that humans taste good, apparently. But, you know, I'm talking about endemic cannibalism. It's not because – I don't bring this up because it's fun. Paul Moon wrote a huge book about it. It's just the truth. You know, war. There was cannibalism, there was slavery. The British the supposedly evil British put a stop to all of that, I reckon deserve a little bit of gratitude instead of this endless moaning that we get. If the British were cannibals, why aren't we doing it now? You know, why aren't we violent now as Maori are? That's the point I'm making. It's because it's been accused, we've been accused of causing Maori violence somehow because of colonisation. That's the only reason I talk about it. It's just absurd.
So can I see if I've got it right here? Were Maori actually engaging in cannibalism before the British came here? Yes, we know that's a historical fact. Was it widely used, or was it only the top of the class elite Maori chiefs doing it? No, it wasn't. At the time, I think what's happening now is completely different to what happened at the time in terms of cannibalism. After all, there have, in fact, been so-called vampire cults exposed even in Hollywood, where stars and things of that nature will go in and drink human blood. This happens at the highest echelons, so both of you are correct. However, the point of bringing cannibalism into it, although it's true, I'm not 100% sure if it relates specifically to Maori violence rates in the developed world.
It's just part of a culture of violence that we see. And, you know, I'm just saying, wouldn't it be smarter of Maori to go forward rather than look backwards? So much of Maori culture is to do with celebrating violence in some form or other. And I'm just saying that's not hell of a useful these days. Surely, I mean, you've got Maori people who are, you know, heavily not Maori, heavily from, you know, interbred with Europeans, yet persist in, or seem to enjoy this looking back to the sort of cannibal days, the kamate kamates and all that. But it's not that, it doesn't really, I don't care what people do in their own, you know, cultural groups. I just care when they start to blame mine for their own problems, their own poor choices, which manifestly is the case these days with a minority of Maori. My grievance is with the grievers, I suppose. I have good relations with many Maori here in the town where I live, and they support me. So this is not a Maori versus Pākehā debate. This is a Maori separatists and European sympathisers versus 80% of the population, including quite a lot of Maori. That's how I wish to characterise the debate, because that's true. I mean, I get asked how many people I speak for. I mean, I don't speak for anyone but me, but how many people share my views? 9 different polls to do with, you know, whether we want Maori privilege, seats at the council table, whether Maori are special. That was a close-up poll. And the number is always 80%, give or take. The top one is 85%. That was whether they want Maori housing in the Bay of Plenty. But there's a real consistency there. It's 80% more or less of New Zealanders don't want a bar of this stuff. And only a few mugs like me are prepared to get up and say that.
Can I make a point here? How long, you used to be an ad man, right, John? Yeah. When did the PC gone mad saying start to come about? And how long has it been instituted? And now you're trying to talk about something that's certainly not PC. And I think, in theory, the idea behind political correctness is to prevent people saying what they really think.
Well, I'll speak up for political correctness a little bit. I mean, it did start with the German communists. But what people really mean about PC, and my great crime, I guess, is being unkind, being mean. What PC has taken to mean is, you know, be kind, be nice. Nicism, I call it. But, you know, I maintain that we have racism in this country. It's not the kind that Joe thinks we have. I think it's coming from the Maori side. And before we can defeat racism, we have to defeat nicism. The nicism that New Zealanders are nice. We're nice people. I maintain we'd rather sell our country down the river to Maori separatists than be called a nasty name, racist. Now, I don't buy it, and I do stand up and say what I think. I don't enjoy it, but I, from my time in advertising, I know that you have to jolt. To make any kind of change, you have to jolt. The lefties know this. I mean, they go marching down the street and they hijack oil rigs and they do what has to be done to jolt. So I use language to jolt. I will say, Maori have come, you know, from the Stone Age to the Space Age in 150 years and haven't said thanks, you know, because I was particularly upset one day.
I'd like to hear from...
Jolt, but it's not very nice, but
I'd like to hear from Joe in a minute, but what you just said, John, reminded me of a comedy sketch by the Māori comedian Peel, who was driving a taxi along with a Pacific Islander taxi driver, and the Pacific Islander was criticizing him, and he said, "You crazy Māoris, you were sailing across the sea in these leaky waka. We just waited for the Palangi to build the 747s. Joe?
Okay, well... Going into what John's banner, where he's shown that the majority of the people are disagree with some of the aspirations of Māori people, what John's doing is he's pretending that there is a something out there called reverse racism, and actually reverse racism doesn't exist. It's imaginary. What it is, it's when governments go and help minorities who are struggling. Now, this is normal for governments to go out and help people who are impoverished, who aren't doing as well as other members of the mainstream society. And what he's pretending is that anything given to Māori is an attack on mainstream Pākehā, which it is not. It's helping poor, impoverished Māori who are trying to make it in society. And so when John says that that colonization has brought Māori from the Stone Age to the Space Age, well, I like to compare that to the Polynesian race. They managed to colonize an area the size of Russia before anyone had even left the British Isles. They had managed to colonize multiple islands. They had star navigation and celestial navigation down to a T. Sure, they didn't have the wheel, but they probably didn't need it because they had sailing craft that could get around the planet. They've gone from Taiwan down to South America, and they've got chicken bones that they've DNA analyzed to find out that Polynesians had actually been down there, and there's also evidence off the coast of California that in Los Angeles that they've also travelled there as well. And the primary evidence of that here in New Zealand is the kumara, or the sweet potato. And you can find that actually originated from South America. So as far as us coming from the Stone Age, I find that hypocritical. I think it's ridiculous. Māori and Polynesian are some of the most advanced races on Earth. We have contributed to the human race just as much as any other people on this planet. Over to you, John.
Could I actually put something in here? Because sea anchors that are of Chinese origin that are thousands upon thousands of years old have been discovered off the California coastline. A Stone Age monument has been discovered in Vermont in the United States. There are mountains of evidence from all around the globe that there used to be one big global seafaring society with all these different races, and there were established trade routes and things of that nature. So Polynesians are nothing special. In my opinion, there's actually only one race. It's called the human race. And we're all brothers, right?
Oh, I agree.
And every brother has stoushes with his siblings and what have you. But what's lacking here, and I think where the debate needs to be facilitated, is to come to perhaps an understanding of what each other's coming from. Mark Twain's quote was, "It's much easier to convince somebody to believe a lie than it is to convince them that they've been fooled." if you know what I mean. And when we're talking about this kind of thing in New Zealand, I don't think our full history has been completely honest. In fact, I doubt any country anywhere has its full history told to it and is accessible to the general population. So when people have arguments, let's say on a radio show or a television show, about things in a historical context, they're talking to people who have no knowledge of this whatsoever. So because they don't have anything to back up or disprove what's going on, basically they just throw it out the window and say, I just don't know what's the truth. And that's the real difficult thing here, and that's what I seek to facilitate here, finding out exactly what the truth is.
May I comment on what Joe said? Because I know that people will think that I am saying, my race is better than your race. Look at my people, are better than... I don't say, and have never said, that Maori are in any way inferior in genetically or otherwise. Maori were in the Pacific. There was no copper, there was no tin, so you weren't going to have a Bronze Age. The vast majority of humanity was clustered in Eurasia, so naturally, their geniuses were able to compare notes, and naturally, the desperation in which they lived, the climatic desperation, required the Eurasians to, think pretty laterally. In the Pacific, things were better. There was a ready supply of food. So, the Polynesians did what they had to do to do well in their environment. I'm just saying that the fact of the matter is, for all those reasons, the British were a more advanced race when they got here in terms of their technology and so on. It's like if a spaceship landed today, the world would have changed. A spaceship from Venus lands, the world just changed, didn't it? There are various things we can do about it. We can say, let's kill them because they're foreign and they could kill us. Then one of us says, actually, that might not be a good idea because they've got tractor beams. And another one of us says, well, I've actually been to Venus and it's not too bad there. And these guys actually want to do a treaty with us, and they seem to want to treat us reasonably well. They want to run things because that's what they do in the universe. And if you think they're bad, you want to see the Martians. So that was the sort of equivalent when Cook's ship hove to in the bay. The world had changed, and the Maori people, or the Hobson ship, if you like, the Maori people at the time, the leaders, had to make a decision. They decided on balance it was best to deal with these guys. And the legacy of that decision is here today. They're thriving. They're living twice as long. They've got all this new technology. They were smart enough, those chiefs. See, when they went from the Stone Age to the Space Age, I'm saying that was a pretty smart decision. The British offered them a way to leap forward 3,000 years technologically. Now, that was a pretty smart thing to do. They could have had 100, 70-odd thousand of them. They could have killed all the Brits that came in. The Brits would have got uppity and probably brought a gunship in, although they weren't of that mood. The English were wet liberals by that stage. They were going to go away if the Maori didn't want to do the treaty. So I think, it's not about, one group of people is better than the other. I actually have a much more positive view of Maori than many of these Maori leaders, I think. Left to their own devices, in the modern world, they do very well. When they're patronised and made to feel inferior by their own people, not surprisingly, they think, oh, well, we're not thought highly of, so we'll just, we'd better behave like dummies then.
Might I interject?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, you have to come to a break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
And welcome back. I wanted to ask, I think when you were on the panel with Willie and JT, I tried to call in, but the show ended before they could get to my call, unfortunately. The question I wanted to ask was, from treaty settlements and things of this nature, what percentage of it filters down to the poorest Maori who are actually affected the most by poverty? Joe, do you know? Because I don't know.
No, I don't have any statistics on the internal goings on and iwi trusts. But I'd also like to address the analogy of what John mentioned with a spaceship turning up. There's more to the spaceship turning up than it just being better technology. What you're looking at is a spaceship turning up to this planet of superior technology. And what they do is they're going to ban your religion. They'll set up their own religion, like the Tuanga Suppression Act. They will ban your sports. They will ban your language. And then what they'll do is they'll confiscate your land. And then what will happen is 55% of your race will die out in their colonization, as did the Māori race. So at the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, went from 100,000 to 47,000 people. So these alien species turning up in superior vessels, colonization's not this lovely, overwhelmingly positive experience that John portrays. It's actually devastating.
Hmm. Well, yeah, over to you, John. I think I'd better come in because I'll just forget all of the things that you've said. Ban the religion. Well, they overwhelmingly endorsed the Martians' religion, or the Venusians' religion, if you like, the British religion. Said thanks, had the good grace in the Kohimarama Conference of 1860. Some of the chiefs that had signed the treaty, like Tamati Wakanani, were there, and others, had the good grace to thank the governor. 200 chiefs, the biggest gathering ever, I think, at that point, to thank the British for the glories of Christianity. I'm not a Christian. I don't like religions. But you have to acknowledge that Christianity was what saved Māori from cannibalism. They talked them out of it, the missionaries. Banning the sports, well, I don't know. Māori seemed pretty good at sport to me. The deaths. Now, yes, there were deaths because there were diseases to which Māori were not immune. And I think everybody regrets that. And that would happen in an intergalactic colonization too, I suppose. By far the greatest cause of Māori depopulation in the 19th century, however, as proved by John Robinson, were the wars in the first half of the 19th century. There were no breeding. The numbers went from about 120,000 to 70,000, provably. And there was a serious shortage of male breeding stock. That, coupled with the practice of female infanticide, which was not just a Maori thing, but is true of, desperate peoples all over the world. The girl is somehow not an economic unit, so they were killed at birth. So that was the major cause. There was it comes down to information, though. I mean, Joe wants to believe that there was a major cause. The major cause was the diseases. I suppose, am happy to believe when I see evidence that it was mainly the wars and the female infanticide. We're both biased, but the numbers built up again in the later part of the 19th century, and they're absolutely booming today. But yes, there was a hiccup. The diseases were definitely a problem. But I don't think the Maori who are there today would say that they would like to go back to the way things were in 1840 before the diseases, but before all of the other things, including medicines, life-preserving medicines, technology, and so forth, and British law, British institutions. Apiranannata put it really well in his book about the Treaty of Waitangi, which is so desperately inconvenient to my opponents, because I agree, he agrees with me, that as you sleep, he told the old lady that he'd written the book for, as we sleep, there are 100 laws keeping us safe. Now, that's mind-blowing when I think about it. It's true. If I want to kill you, Vinny, I have to think twice because there's all these things that would happen to me, which didn't happen before. Māori law was basically might is right. They were basically like sparrows at a birdbath, wondering who was going to come and knock them on the head next or who they were going to knock on the head. British law brought that security, property rights and security. So I don't know if I've covered the list, Joe, but you know, there is another side to that story.
However, John, you've kind of failed to address some of the points that Joe raised. Like, for example, the suppression of the Tauranga Act, and also the banning of Maori language in schools and things of
that. Let me do that. I'm not an expert on the Tauranga Suppression Act. I think it was 1908 I presume they had their reasons. Presumably, people must have been dying from dubious... the equivalent today would be, you know, homeopathy for cancer or something. I don't know. I won't pretend to understand that. I do have some enlightenment about the teachers in schools, the language. The Maori chiefs themselves insisted to the Ministry of Education that their children should not be taught in Maori-only schools. They should be taught English. Now, this is what is conveniently left out when Maori people say that, oh, my grandmother was beaten. Well, I'll tell you what, at a boarding school in 1970, we were beaten as well. physical punishment was right through the system in those days and ended relatively recently. But if they weren't allowed to speak Maori, that was at least in part because the chiefs saw that English was the way of the future, a bit like Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore deciding that English would be the language of Singapore. Wouldn't have gone down that well, but by God, it's improved Singapore's prospects.
Mm. Joe, your response?
Well, I'd like to address some of those points that John detailed out. And the New Zealand Musket Wars, as John mentioned, which is prior to the New Zealand Wars, he said that many Māori died probably in the range of 100,000. Well, one thing, and also his buddy Don Brash mentioned this in the Oriwa hate speech. One of the things that really astounds me with this, with these numbers that they've managed to pull out of thin air, is how do they know this? Because there were no births, deaths, and records. No one was calculating how many people were in each iwi in New Zealand. There was no records of birth, deaths, or records of Māori. So you couldn't calculate how many people were dying in these. And I think what they've managed to miss is that when Māori went to war, it wasn't to go and exterminate each other. They did it for this thing called mana. And what they were trying to do was achieve mana. It wasn't to go out and exterminate one another as the history that John's portraying. But also another topic that John brought up was diseases with when British colonists came over with diseases. Well, actually, a lot of the British colonists were really badly disease-ridden, and what had happened is they'd spent a year on these sailing vessels coming out to New Zealand to colonise it, and the diseases had spread through the ship. So, for example, in Otago Harbour, there's Quarantine Island where they used to keep all of the new colonists until some of them culled off with disease. So what Māori were excluded from was public health to the 1930s. So it's acceptable that colonists turn up here with diseases, but you do not exclude the Indigenous people from public health when they are also suffering from diseases you've introduced. It's absolutely unfair.
Mm. Now, at the same time, Joe, as you're saying, there's no birth and death records and whatnot. Are you also saying that there was a huge amount of Māori who got killed at the same time as not having any records yourself? Or is this just the different part of the century we're talking?
Well, they'd done some counting of the Māori race in the 1800s. But prior to the Treaty of Waitangi, there was no... the last count, I believe, was probably Cook. And he maybe put the race at maybe 25,000. But, I mean, that's just...
100,000, I think.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure Māori can count. You know, much is made, especially in the Waitangi Tribunal, of the power of Māori oral history. So if we're now saying that they couldn't count how many they had... I mean, this information was gained from various iwi. John Robinson, when he was a scientist, Harvard, I think he was, or MIT, he was hired by the Waitangi Treaty of Waitangi Research Unit at Victoria University. He subsequently exposed their bias and their requirement that he alter his findings because they weren't to their taste, so he's unpopular. He had put out a book called The Corruption of New Zealand Democracy by pointing that out. But his way of calculating was to take the first known census, the first reliable census, 1858, I think it was, and work back in terms of likely birth rates and death rates. And by that method, he got from the whatever the population figure was in 1858 back to a plausible estimate of what the population was in 1840, which I think he said was 70,000. As to where he got the figures for how many had died, I mean, it doesn't matter anyway now. It doesn't matter, but certainly there were over 1,000 wars, I mean, of one kind or another. They were constantly at war because there was no property rights. There were no there was no security. The British brought that. What I'd like to jump forward and say is that regardless of all this and who was right and who was eating who and so on, what child today who is Maori or part Maori is disadvantaged by, say, the education system? I mean, Charles Bennett had the, was honest enough to say that if there's any bias, it's pro-Maori. That was when he was alive, which was a while ago. You know, Maori get every advantage, scholarships and so on, people bending over backwards to help them in all ways in society. What Maori child, I said this to a guy called Carwin Jones, who I accused. He said, you've called me a sort of pretend Maori. I said, no, I didn't, Carwin. I called you a make-believe Maori. He says, well, yeah, exactly. What do you mean? I said, well, you're Welsh. You've got red hair and white skin and your name's Carwin Jones. And I said, what reason do you have for your children getting money from my children? He said, oh, well, my great-grandmother was prevented from speaking Maori in school. I said, well, there you go. See, my wife comes from Taiwan. She's one of those immigrants that Te Ururoa Flavel thinks shouldn't be helped at the expense of Maori. And, you know, guess what? Her son wasn't allowed to speak Chinese in school. I don't think he tried, but, it wasn't encouraged. She taught it to him at home, and I said, what is stopping your grandmother from, what was stopping her from making sure that her children spoke Maori at home? So he wasn't terribly convincing. He went off in a huff. But I do want to know why my children should be paying money when it comes down to it. It is all about money, not mana. It's about money. There's no mana in taking other people's money.
And considering it was...
I couldn't get an answer.
And considering it was the chiefs themselves who told the ban on speaking Māori in school because they wanted to be taught in English, that kind of makes it not make sense anymore.
Well, those chiefs were very sensible. I think Māori today should give thanks to their people. I don't criticise them. Those same chiefs were into cannibalism and all that stuff, but then so were our lot, if you go back far enough. Those chiefs realised that they had been living a sort of counterproductive lifestyle, and they sought to change. They thought there was a much debate at Waitangi. You'll see the speeches left, right and centre. They were clearly of the understanding they were surrendering sovereignty because some of the chiefs absolutely vociferously said, I don't want to be down, down, down while the governor is up, up, up. Go home, go home. In the end, they signed. And in the end, by majority, those chiefs made a great decision for their people, just as we would if the Venusians came and we decided on balance with all the risks of what these guys might do if they don't turn out to be as friendly as we think. With all that, those risks paid off. We took the decision and the risks paid off, and Maori are doing very well today. Not as well, if you like, because it hasn't been a few generations, not as well as the people who had the advantage of being technologically, more advanced, but very well compared with other, native people and with where they used to be. And we're all doing much better than we used to then. I agree with you, Vinny. It is about, the superior race that I'm in favour of is the human race. We're a wonderful species, how we solve our problems. There's not much between us all, and we'll certainly band together when the Venusians really do come, or the Martians. We'll suddenly realise all these differences that we squabble about are not really at all significant.
Mm.
That's all I want, is racial equality, and for that I'm often called a racist.
Well, can I ask, what's the definition of racism? Is it discriminating against a race, or is it being in favour of a race?
It's both. I deplore apartheid in South Africa. John Minto of the Mana Party was very, very strong, a very strong New Zealander in those days. He has gone quiet when it comes to the black majority rule in Zimbabwe and places like that. I think you've got to be consistent. If you deplore apartheid in South Africa, you've also got to deplore it when it starts showing itself in New Zealand and other places, albeit not as extremely. But when you've got people like Te Ororoa Flavel saying that Maori are superior or should get more, that is the same thing. It's on a different part of the continuum, but it's the same thing. And, you know, it's my mission to show that Joe's side of the argument is actually where the racism is. And I think that's legitimate.
Joe, can I ask you, after British colonization, the treaty and all of this kind of thing, I was thinking about tribes and communities, how they worked and how they maintained their sense of unity together, and whether or not that's eroded over time. And as a result of no longer having community and strong family support networks, and this has happened right across society, there's way more divorce now than ever before, way more delinquent children now than ever before. Are Māori a victim of the same kind of phenomenon as everyone else, with the exception that they get racially targeted by the justice system?
So, are you meaning, like, back historically?
No. You know how, let's say, for example, not even 20, 30 years ago, everybody used to know their neighbours? Nobody knows their neighbours now. And all that whole community, all that extended family living with you and everything like that, doesn't exist now. All of those used to be support networks so that people would keep out of trouble and have some kind of culture for themselves. And now what it is, it's television, drugs, cigarettes, everything coming at you. So you don't stand a chance without a proper support network. Anybody's like that.
Well, historically, how Māori lived is they lived in communal pā sites. And so the pā sites were very communal. They kind of lived in a whānau system. And it was an ideal type of lifestyle. So there was a governor Fox, who became the Premier of New Zealand, the Prime Minister, and he once says, "They are beastly cannibals living in hoary cannibalism." And he despised the fact that Māori were a communal people and they weren't capitalist. So that would probably be why they attacked a lot of the pā sites. And so Māori got forced off their lands with the New Zealand Settlements Act, and they had to live in more swampish areas. And so the prime land where the pā sites were given over to the British colonists when the all this territory was confiscated in the Settlements Act. So Māori kind of have struggled being forced off their lands and having to live in these swamp areas, and then having to, into the 20th century, having to come into the cities and also adjust to urban lifestyle. But I noticed John spoke about racism and the definitions of racism, and I'll actually give you the official definition of racism. It is the attitudinal or ideological phenomenon that accepts racial superiority and, when present in those with power, justifies them using that power to discriminate against and deprive others of what is rightfully theirs on the basis of their race. So what that means is the people in New Zealand that have the power is certainly not Māori.
Hmm. So who's being deprived of their money to pay for Māori scholarships? Is it Māori?
Well, no one's being deprived because they are...
Where does the money come from? Where does it come from?
From treaty settlements.
And who pays those?
The Crown.
And who pays their taxes to the Crown?
Māori.
Everybody, doesn't it?
Got him. Look, it's those 80% once again who, you know, who are being fleeced. Look, you've skipped a whole period of history. Maori always do this, these radical Maori. Always skip to the confiscations. Confiscations had a cause, Joe. Now, here's a guy. His name is Wiramu Tamihana. He was one of the more moderate chiefs. Can you see that?
Give me a second. You've got to put that up a little.
A little higher?
A little bit higher.
I'm reading
and pull it back a little. But
pull it back.
Pull it up, way back. Way back and up. There you go. That's about right. I'll read that for you. I shall spare neither unarmed people nor property. Wiramu Tamihana, July 18, 1863, on the Waikato plan to attack Auckland.
He was going to kill every man, woman, and child in Auckland. That's what he was planning to do. He was one of the more moderate ones. The Maori were trying to drive the Pākehā into the sea. Now, I don't think they were going to have swimming lessons when they got there. They were going to kill everyone. They'd signed a treaty, and they breached it, as Sir Apirananata very unhelpfully pointed out. Our people rose up. They were naughty. They rose up. They were warned. They were... and now here's another one. Now, about here, this is Governor Gray.
Down a little. Those who wage war against Her Majesty or remain in arms must take the consequences of their acts.
And I won't put up the other slides. The other ones go, and must understand they will forfeit the right to possession of their lands guaranteed to them by the Treaty of Waitangi. These lands will be occupied by a population capable of protecting for the future the quiet and unoffending from the violence with which they have been threatened. Now, I argue that Governor Gray is New Zealand's Lincoln. Thank God we had Governor Gray, or we wouldn't be here. He was New Zealand's Lincoln. He kept his country together. That's what a governor did in those days. He was a much stronger leader than anyone I can think of since. And he did what he promised. You know, they rose up and he took their lands off them. Now, one can argue about the quantity, and some of them were given back, some of them weren't. You can certainly argue that had the Maori won, they would have confiscated a hell of a lot more than land. They would have confiscated, by their own track record up to that point, the lives of every man, woman and child, and they were claiming to want to do the same. They didn't attack Auckland because Grey stopped them. So I want to inject that into the discussion when we start moaning about confiscations. It must be put in context that the confiscations were done because they waged war on the Crown and lost.
I'm sorry, guys, for the interruption here. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Don't you go anywhere. And welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Now, if there is support for Māori out there, my personal belief is in volunteerism. For example, I've filmed a number of and interviewed a number of Māori activists and tried to help them get the word out about their various causes, the struggles of their hapū and so on and so forth. That's how I contribute in my own way to the success of Māori. I don't take from other people and give to anybody else what I'm not willing to give up myself. Is there a disconnect and perhaps a lack of community motivation to help Māori directly, perhaps because they're being forced to do it instead of being asked?
Well, yes, I think that people don't like to be forced, especially on false pretenses, when they know that the facts are not being presented properly. I don't know any racists. I certainly know I'm not one. The people that are accused of being racist, I think, are well-meaning. People like Martin Dutre lived among Maori, got his information about the Celtic New Zealand, which is a bad choice of word, really, but the pre-Maori people, he got that from the Komatua that he lived among. He's a very warm man, and he is well-disposed towards Maori. So am I. I want to see them do well. I just happen to come from that sort of right-wing thing. It's like it's a difference between a soft mother and a tough dad, if you like. Now, I think you can argue that a strong dad, not a violent one, a strong dad is a pretty good parent when it comes to it. He doesn't choke his kids with sweets. And that's what your sort of right-wing in politics, if you like, is saying. It's still love. It's just a tougher love, and it's saying, look, you don't get anywhere by lying around on welfare. One You've would got to argue, turn up for a job, you know, that sort of thing. That's another kind of love, but it's still love.
One would argue, John, that one needs both a soft mother and a hard father.
Yes.
And at the moment, the government is depriving not just Māori, but everybody of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if a kid says, can I have a box of chocolates? The easy thing to do is say, oh, yeah, sure, because you'll love me and you'll think I'm wonderful. You may not in 10 years' time when when your teeth have fallen out. Yeah, there needs to be carrot and stick. There needs to be compassion. And, you know, we live in essentially a socialist society where people, where more than anywhere else on earth probably, people do get money for falling, into hard times. It's just a question of degree of money and, you know, how much is enough.
Can I ask? Joe, I think your speakers are up a bit loud there, but it's feedback. Joe, I was wondering, where does the disconnect happen here? Because I see that there is a racism problem in New Zealand. Anybody who knows New Zealand knows that there is at least a little bit of racism out there. I've got cousins from up north. Bro, trust me, they're racist. And it exists. It's a very real thing. I'm wondering, where's the disconnect? When does it stop being a racial thing, and when does it start being a political ideology thing? Because I noticed that the two people here debating whether or not to socialise help for Māori, one happens to be from a left-wing party, and one has rather right-wing views. Is there a disconnect, or are they one and the same?
Yes, Vinny, there is a disconnect. Part of the reason that stems from the racism of New Zealand is the false histories that are being portrayed by people like Martin Dutry. Now, the foremost expert in the New Zealand wars is James Balich. He wrote the New Zealand Wars. James Balich. Now, as John mentioned, the invasion of Auckland, he denies it. He denies it emphatically. He says that Māori had no intention of invading Auckland because the trade was just too good. They were trading with Auckland City. What the invasion of the Waikato was a defensive war. That would be precisely because there were par sites built at Rangiriri, and what Governor Grey had done is he marched 2/3 of the British Army down Great South Road to attack the Waikato for land acquisition. Nothing more. It wasn't to help the natives. It was just for greedy land acquisition. Now, I know about John's obsession with Saparana Nata, which he's actually taken Saparana Nata's life out of context and cherry-picked out bits of his life that are appealing to him. I like to present James Fitzgerald. Now, James Fitzgerald was a Pākehā man, and he was born in the United Kingdom. And I got this information out of the Parliament debates on November 5th of 1863, and this explains in depth that Māori had no idea that they were going to be invaded in the Waikato. I'll read it out. This, sir, is proposed to be done. This great, what I call, this enormous crime is proposed to be perpetrated against a race whom have been refused the right of representation in this house, who at this moment are totally and absolutely in ignorance that we are about to make this great invasion upon their privileges. I'll go forward. I know that it has been, and it has sometimes been said, that the policy which has been advocated by one party in this country has been a policy dictated solely by the desire to acquire lands for the settlers. I object to this upon the grounds that these two grounds. I object first upon the ground that it is contrary to the Treaty of Waitangi, which distinctly guaranteed and pledged the faith of the Crown that the lands of the natives shall not be taken from them except by the ordinary process of the law that is taken within the meaning of the treaty. Lastly, again, I object because I conceive the provision to be in direct opposition to the section of Constitution Act which debars us from making any law which is repugnant to the law of England. So what he's done there is he's described that in the first section that Māori have no idea they're about to get invaded. Secondly, what he's also said is that the people who are voting in Governor Gray have voting him for a single purpose is to grab land for themselves. It's land acquisition. It's nothing. All these ideals of queen and country are just rubbish. It's land acquisition.
A corporation financing John Key because they want to acquire power companies or something.
And lastly, the land acquisition was illegal because it was inconsistent with the Constitutions Act. Now, in the Treaty of Waitangi, Māori had been guaranteed they were British subjects under British law, so that in the Constitutions Act of England, the state is not allowed to procure private land. So all of this history that is being told by Martin Dutry and John and the NZCPR and all these other organisations, and that single statement debunks all of that information.
What do you make of this? Is this visible?
Yep, that's visible.
This is the amount of land that was sold willingly by Māori before 1840. The whole South Island and a fair chunk of the North. You know, that's the thing. Of the 25 million acres or whatever it is, acres, I think, hectares of New Zealand, about 23 million was happily sold. You see, Māori were not sheep farmers. They didn't know about making money from trees or sheep. Their surplus land was surplus land. It was just so many trees. They were using a certain part of it, and the rest of it, if they could get a buck for it, which they weren't using, damn right they were going to, and they did in large numbers. Now, you're putting up some guy called Fitzgerald. I'm not – I don't have a view on him. I don't know of him. I'm putting up the greatest Maori statesman of all time. That's why he's so embarrassing. That's the conclusion he came to. You can always find, as you and I are both doing, we can always cherry pick the person that suits us. We can always find someone to back up our claim. One random pom, and you're spoken like a true Brit, which I presume you are, called Joe Trindall. I'm sure you have a lot of my kind of blood there.
I'm actually Irish, John.
Yeah. Irish. So many. Yeah. The Irish and the Maori have a mutual hatred of the English.
Oh, yes, we do.
Very, very good at joining forces. And I know a Maori Irish woman. She's fantastic at it. But look, this is what is happening. We're arguing away. We're both doing quite well with our arguments. It all happened a hell of a long time ago. You know.
In fact, that's a good point, John.
No, so why are we still arguing? Why is one outfit claiming 15% of the population saying that they need to be 50% of the decision-making? That's just plainly unfair today. This is the 21st century now. Whatever happened then is arguable from both sides. Now, this is why I'm standing up, I guess, because I just want people to know that there's another side. I win if people know there's another side to what's being said, because it's only one side that's been heard up to now.
If I may, you made the point that we're living in a socialist country now, John, which is basically socialising compensation to Māori. And I get that. It's the whole thing. We've got welfare and all of this sort of stuff. It comes from a very loving place, but in a lot of ways it can, in fact, be damaging. What I want to know is precisely how you would propose to help Māori if not for the current socialising programs that are being used?
Well, the same way as we help everybody else in our compassionate country. Everybody gets helped. I mean, this is another slide I was going to put up, so now is a good time because it relates to this. I tell the media whenever I get the chance, look, poll the public, especially since I know what the polls are going to say. Should all New Zealanders have the same rights,
obey the same laws, vote on the same roll, help those in need because of their need, not because of their race?
That's the thing. because of their need, not because of their race. It's very important that we do that. Otherwise, you find that people who happen to have a smidgen of Maori, like, you know, some Irishman like Steve O'Regan, for example, who's only a Maori of convenience, you know, get ahead of the queue in the hospitals. That's just not fair. New Zealanders are a fair people. You know, we've got a fair democracy. We do help people in minority positions. Wasn't always so, perhaps. But it's vital that we have equal access to all of our resources. And that's all I'm asking for, really. When you get one person who might have to drop off the list but to make way for some Maori person just because they're Maori, that offends people.
Mm.
Offensive. You know, that's not going to happen all that often, but that the principle of that is offensive.
Joe?
Well, there's good reason why this is happening, and it comes down to Article 2 of the Treaty of Waitangi, and it says in the Treaty of Waitangi, to the chiefs and tribes of New Zealand and to the respective families and individuals thereof, the full and exclusive and undisturbed possession of their lands and estates, forests and fisheries and other properties. So basically what this means to me, it's everything between heaven and earth. From wind rights, water rights, you name it. That's pretty much what it is. And Right. And if it is, it doesn't mean those things, then it's being confiscated. So,
can I ask, Joe, just on that point, do British citizens have those same rights or not?
No, it's to the people who signed up to the Treaty of Waitangi, their families.
So the British didn't sign up to the Treaty of Waitangi as well as the Māori, or?
No, it guarantees to the chiefs and tribes of New Zealand and to the respective families. It doesn't. So what goes wrong here is people are misinterpreting the Treaty of Waitangi. They believe that when they get citizenship, so we could have someone jump off the boat from Syria or Iraq or some other exotic place, and the 534 chiefs that signed the Treaty of Waitangi, they just didn't sign it off to anyone who turned up here and got New Zealand citizenship. They made sure that they protected the interests of their families moving forward, and it doesn't matter about their blood quantum, whether they're 1/1,000,000th of a zillionth of Māori, it was that they were respective family members.
Right. Can I leap in here? Complete fabrication, that. You're relying on the so-called official version of the treaty, which bears no relation to the one that I say is the only one that counts, which is the Māori Tiriti. If you want to see what that meant, you look at the Littlewood draft that was found in 1989 and so effectively covered up, and you don't see any mention of forests and fisheries, and you see that it means all the people, it's with all the people of New Zealand. Now, we can argue about that, what that means. Joe will argue that all the people of New Zealand doesn't mean that. It means all the Maori people of New Zealand. Well, I think that's hugely debatable. I think there are certain principles. This gets me back to Belich as well. There are two principles. One is called Occam's razor. I'm not quite sure why. Not sure who Occam was or what his razor was about, but it's basically...
He was the inventor of Gillette.
Yeah. If you're stuck for an explanation, you take the simplest one. And there's another principle, a historical principle of historians, that if you're stuck for who to believe, you take the historian that wrote about it closest to the time. Mm-hmm. So starting with Belich, we are supposed to discard the work of people like James Cowan, whose father fought in the wars, who interviewed a lot of people who were still alive from that time, and we're supposed to defer to the wishes of a lefty called James Belich. I worked for his father, former mayor of Wellington, Labour. Now, that doesn't prove anything. It just shows the political agenda. You're supposed to believe people like Dame Claudia Orange, who didn't even mention the Littlewood draft's discovery, despite the fact that she was the first historian to cite it, and she said at that time, oh, this will be tricky politically. But she didn't even mention that in her updated book about the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, to me, that omission says more than all the other words in the book put together about her agenda.
I think it also, John, just remember that you're one of the few people in this country who chooses to talk about these things the way you do, namely because what happens in society when you talk about things that are not comfortable with people, that are offensive, that are in their face, you will draw a lot of heat and flack for it. And if you are employed and you can be fired from your position, that's often a reason why people will choose to omit certain things because they don't want to upset the apple cart.
And you become somewhat unemployable, believe me, I know. But I just can't remember why I was talking about Occam's razor, the simple...
The simple explanation about the Littlewood Treaty.
Right. Look, I have to confess I've just lost...
Actually, right now is the perfect point to go take a WikiLeak and take a break. But, John, quickly finish your point.
Well, it's a question of which treaty we are talking about. And there are certain words in the Treaty of Waitangi, whichever version, that give Maori an excuse to inflate. Joe would have us believe that the Maori brought the British in on some sort of management contract to manage the country, which they would continue to own and get all the benefits from. And they'd own everything from the soil to the sky, and the Brits would get nothing, and that would be seen by Queen Victoria as totally proper. That's absolute nonsense. Of course they didn't. And you get that by distorting meanings of words like taonga. You go back to the dictionary current at the time, you find that taonga, as defined by Chief Hongi Hika, no less, meant property procured by the spear. Here it is, the inflation of the word taonga to suit Maori greed over time. It now means treasure and everything we take a shine to. You know, and I've done this one which says, Chief Hongi Hika saying, let us march on the Waitangi Tribunal and spear the 4G spectrum. This is the sort of nonsense. Maori have a wonderful sense of humour. Everybody loves it. And they're using their sense of humour and they're taking us all for a ride, and it's a big joke and it's time to stop.
If this debate was a cup of coffee, a kind of coffee bean, it would be a robusta. We'll be right back after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Check out our sponsors on the homepage, and also bear in mind that this is a listener-supported broadcast that does not survive without your contributions. If you wish for content like this that at least allows people the platform to speak their truth, then please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And go ahead, make a donation or start a subscription and a regular gifting today. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery, if you lose your sense of humour, you will go friggin' nuts. And my very special guests tonight are diametrically opposed, as much in political ideology, historical context, and skin pigment. My John Hansel and Joe Trinder, welcome back, gentlemen.
G'day. I wouldn't mind some of Joe's pigment.
Yeah.
It's too white. It can be too white sometimes.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, we're talking about racism and this debate. And for me, it's starting to look like it's not actually a racial debate. It's actually more a political/historical debate, much along the lines of the persecution of Holocaust revisionists not too long ago. Would you agree with that, John?
I don't know about your last comment about the Holocaust, but I do think that this is an ideological debate. I think, Māoridom today, not so much a coherent race as an ideology, the Māoridom. The radical Māoridom is more of an ideology or a religion. The race, I don't know, races are all that relevant anyway. I mean, you get people of different skin colours in different countries. You get, Brits talking with African accents and so on. I mean, it's culture is a set of habits, and that's what we're talking about. It often coincides with skin pigment, where those people live in those places, but also they move around. I have a Taiwanese stepson who speaks like a Kiwi, and so his race is not as bigger part of his identity is the habits that he has formed. Some of those habits are Kiwi now. So I think it comes down to politics. You know, Joe's from the left, I'm from the right. We've got our points of view. And the race thing just sort of dovetails in there, but it's not a necessary part of our makeup, I don't think. It doesn't. But I do think that somebody on my blog said that they visited Dachau. This is some teacher guy who's making a complaint about the program on Native Affairs last week. He's complaining to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. And sort of by the way, he was saying, why do people stick to these views? Why do the Nazis not, you know, not plead guilty at Nuremberg when they were obviously guilty? He said, well, he and the prison guard decided that it's because Nazism was such a big part of their identity that to deny it would sort of, their identity would evaporate. Now, I know it's bad taste to bring up that particular analogy. It's just sort of useful. But, you know, looking at Annette Sykes, I mean, I think a big part of her identity would evaporate if she was not pushing the Maori barrow. Being Maori to her is a major part of her identity. Being Pākehā or being a British-descended New Zealander is not a big part of my makeup. I don't think about it much.
What you're describing, John, is cognitive dissonance. When somebody threatens your worldview, the likelihood is to ignore them and then attack them.
Yeah, well, see, I think that Māoridom have got such pride. The Māori Renaissance has been so successful, but it means that people see themselves, perhaps half of Māoridom, the ones that are on the Māori roll, see themselves as Māori first, second and third, and New Zealand next. Much of the rest of the population don't particularly think about their race. Now, arguably, that's because we're the sort of majority and, you know, we're comfortable with that and we don't have to think about ourselves in any sort of desperate way. But I just think it's a little bit unhealthy to focus so much of one's identity on that particular aspect and all of the money and grubbing opportunities that go with it, because that's really what I think it's about. Money, not mana. Money before mana. Now, that will be very insulting to Joe, but, you know, being the person I am, I'm putting it up there, that it is about, you know, Maori have got the hang of this British law and they're using it for all it's worth. You have to reinvent the treaty and go for the doctor on the law, on the legal front, and the bloody whites are giving it to them, and it's great.
Sorry for the interruption, guys, but we've got to be taking a break right now. We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're speaking with Joe Trinder and John Ansell. And if I might say so, I've spoken to some Komatua myself, and I asked him. He's no longer with us now, but I asked him if Maori have the equivalent to what Europeans have, an elite that basically govern over our people and fleece us for all we're worth, and leave most of us out in the cold. And he said, absolutely.
Well, the chief structure was there, you know, and of course in English society, there was the feudal structure, the lord of the manor and so on. Well, I think there's more of a carryover of that in Maori society. I don't know how they enjoy the communistic aspect. There's a tremendous feeling of family among Maori that many of us sort of envy, I think. But when it comes to the power and who controls the land and so on, you know, an individual, you know, capitalistically inclined Maori who just wants to get his share and do something with his land can't do it because that communism is still there. I don't know what – I tried to talk to Ella Henry in the green room the other day about that. She was defending it. If I was a Maori, I'd want my share. I'd want to be able to behave as an individual. But that's what people like me say, isn't it? This collective thing is all very well if you like your relations and the group, but if you're sort of out of whack, well, it could be extremely counterproductive, I would have thought. What do you think, Joe? I mean, this idea of collectively owning land, does that work for you?
Well, I notice that yous always talk about the Maori elite, and I'll put it to you that I don't believe that there is a Maori elite. I think that the entrenched treaty hate industry is a gravy train designed by the 1% of the population that control 50% of the New Zealand economy. And what it's designed to do is work as a distraction so that he have these evil Māori over here who are doing trying to get treaty settlements, and then you have this other group over here that no one's seen at all, that own 50% of the economy, and they're committing tax evasion of $10 billion when treaty settlements are only $1.2 billion drip-fed to 36 different iwi over a period of about 20 years. So an example of that is I can give of that John has been influenced by the 1% that control 50% of the economy is Lewis Crimp. He is definitely one of the 1%ers, and he's funding you, John. And there's no denying about that.
So do you believe, Joe, that there's no Māori 1%? There's nobody in Māoridom that is wealthy and hasn't got Māori's best interest at heart?
Okay, there's 1% of the population of New Zealand that control 50% of the economy, and there's no Māori in that 1%. That certainly ain't Māori. If you really wanted to be of service to your country, John, I would go and look at the 1% of the people that aren't Māori that control 50% of the New Zealand economy. That's where the true tax evasion is going on in this country. They're the real enemy of poverty. They're the parasites of poverty, those people.
Good speech. You didn't answer my question, but never mind. I got to say, this thing about Lewis Crimp, he's a very convenient man to put up. Yes, he gave me some money 2 or 3 years ago. It enabled me to work full-time on this for that period of time, and someone else did as well. And that's what people do in private enterprise. They ask people for money because the state's not going to give it to me when I'm criticising the state. But I'm certainly not, I don't have that money now, and I'm not asking for any more. Now, you were talking about the 1%. Now, people like John Key and that are giving this stuff to Māori. I don't know why you're saying that they're not, but the guys on the left are always at the rich. I mean, the rich are the people that provide all the jobs. You don't seem to see the connection there. But I don't defend the rich when they do badly. I just noticed that the rich do seem to be self-disciplined and live in nice houses and also extremely generous. You mentioned that man in Southland. Well, he's done a hell of a lot for Invercargill. You go down there and ask what Lewis Crimp's done for Invercargill. I'm not defending him particularly, but he gets a bad press. But he gives an awful lot of his money away, and so he's entitled to. This is just sort of resentment of people with money. People with money equate to people who found a way to do service to people and clip the ticket. You know, people without money generally haven't found a way to be of service to people and haven't clipped the ticket. You know, so let's not have any of that. I'm not even sure where you're going with that, so perhaps I'll stop because I've lost my thread of why you're bringing in the...
Are we able to go back to the Littlewood paper?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joe.
The Littlewood paper. Yep.
Okay, before the break, John was mentioning about the Littlewood paper, and I'll explain what the Littlewood paper is. This is it here. It's a scrap piece of paper that was found in Manurewa in South Auckland in 1989. It mysteriously turned up 1 year before the first treaty settlement. The Littlewood paper is being pushed by a chap called Martin Dutre, who is also running another conspiracy theory about pre-Māori Celtics. It was found by brother and sister John Littlewood and Beryl Needham. And it was originally designed for Clendon, who was the American consulate, and it was not supposed to end up in South Auckland. It was actually supposed to end up in Washington, D.C. But it's been investigated by the world's foremost expert in treaty historian, and that's Dame Claudia Orange. She's travelled the entire world investigating the Treaty of Waitangi. John.
And yet she didn't mention it in her comprehensive book on the treaty. You know, if you were a credible historian and you'd found this document after 149 years that everybody knew had gone missing, even if you thought, oh, it wasn't the document or you had some political agenda not to want to acknowledge that it was, you would mention it in your comprehensive book about the Treaty of Waitangi, but she didn't mention it at all, even though she was the person that first saw it. And the handwriting, which was transparently obviously that of James Busby, who everybody knows was the guy who wrote the final draft out, it took them 11 years before Phil Parkinson, Dr. Phil Parkinson, acknowledged by accident in some sort of in-house journal, which Martin Dutray happened to find because he was at National Library at the time, that it was, in fact, Busby's handwriting. So that's that Occam's razor thing that I was talking about before. The simplest argument is usually the one. Now, the simplest thing that it was the Littlewood draft. It was dated the 4th of February, which is the date that everybody knows that the final draft was written. All that people like Dame Claudia and that fellow Loveridge, who was brought in to do the hatchet job on Martin's book, could say was that this seasoned British bureaucrat got the date wrong. Got the date wrong. Now, you know, the Occam's razor principle is that that's nonsense. The most likely explanation is that he got the date right, and it was the document that we say it is. Over to you, Joe. Have another go.
I want to ask who benefits. I mean, who benefits from the current treaty process as it is and who loses out? Do you know?
Well, can I respond to
Sure, go ahead. I'm John sorry.
There? We're hearing from John every day how there's historians, national historians, that he dismisses, like Paul Moon, who's, and also Dame Claudia Orange and James Balich, and also Michael King. And we're hearing that all these professional historians that have dedicated their entire lives to an education in history, and also the professors in universities, that we need to dismiss them. Well, it astounds me. Why would we go and dismiss the foremost experts in these fields?
The reason why I would, John, if I might ask her, is because historically the foremost experts have been wrong about absolutely everything, from disease to, you know, to politics. But yeah.
But Joe, you're making out that this is somehow outrageous that I'm doing it. Those people are the ones who negated the work of the historians that were closest to the action. They said, oh, they can't be right because they're Anglo-centric. In other words, all of their lifetime spent doing diligent work. They had no agendas in those days. There was no treaty scam or industry. They just told it as it was. They are to be dismissed, and we, the new socialist historians, like James Balich and Dame Claudia Orange and Paul Moon. I mean, Paul Moon said about the Littlewood document, it can't be a treaty because it wasn't signed. You know, what rubbish that is. I mean, we never said it was a treaty. We've always said it was a draft. Of course you don't sign a draft. It was a scrap of paper. You're absolutely right. It was a scrap of paper written after much consideration, after numerous drafts. The final draft was written down in Busby's handwriting on the 4th of February, taken across the bay where Reverend Henry Williams and his son translated it into Te Tiriti o Waitangi, as best they could, and that's the document that was signed. But to put your point of view, you've got to go against these established principles of history writing, the principle of the simplest explanation is the best. You might be right, but I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, to what you're saying is that the establishment is always right. Why are you a member of Mana?
Well, I'm not saying that the establishment's right. I'm just saying that people wouldn't spend their entire lives at a profession to go and deceive the public on stuff they've worked on and travelled the planet doing and getting paid for as professors. They're not paid for by the New Zealand government to deceive the public. They do this because it's their passion in life. And then to come out with these fantastical theories that someone like Martin Dutray is is who's got no law degree, just saw a couple of dints and a couple of rocks, and thinks that he knows more than professors. It just
doesn't seem realistic. That is an outrageous slur on Martin Dutre. I've come to respect that guy. I am as suspicious of conspiracy theorists as anybody else, so I ask them lots of questions. People like Martin Dutre, Ross Baker, I nibble away at the finer points of the Littlewood document or the Celtic stuff, whatever. They always come back, or he in particular, Dutre, always comes back with a cogent answer. He deserves respect, and he deserves to be responded to with more than just character assassination. When people respond with character assassination, that shows me that they are being dishonest and they don't have any answer to the guy's explanations. You know, we went up there with on Mount Albert on my birthday, the 21st of March, autumn equinox this year, and we watched the sun come up in a trench that was cut by the Patuparaiahe, according to Martin, according to the Kamatua who told it to him, right in the slot at Mount Wellington, right when it was supposed to. And he took them up there to do that. He took them all around Auckland to show them these things, and none of it appeared on the program. Why not?
Now, here's the other thing. Do you believe, Joe, considering you were the one who kind of suggested we have this debate, that the mainstream media is covering John and Martin Dutre's points perhaps in their full detail? Joe?
Hey, Joe.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, first off, when you look at Martin Dutre's conspiracy theory, and that's all it is, there's no reality in it. Because I used to be in the Royal New Zealand Navy. I've travelled, I've done some maritime travel. And the distance from Britain, where he's saying the Celtics come from at the time of Christ, is approximately 24,000 kilometres. To start a civilization in a country, NASA have actually discovered that you need to have a minimum of 15 women on board for genetic variance, or else the people die the civilization will die off if it doesn't have genetic variance. But we live in the 21st century, and we've got a civilization that now has things like aircraft and ships and refrigerators, and we also have a great degree of medical knowledge. So back then, the Celtics were quite a primitive people. And what they didn't understand was there was things like malaria and also other diseases that you get when you go and travel long distances. Scurvy is a prime example. So they'll be reluctant to get out of the Atlantic Ocean and to get into the Pacific Ocean at the time of Christ. So the very first European to reach the Pacific Ocean was Ferdinand Magellan. He's not just challenging Māori history, New Zealand history. He's recreating European history. This is this whole fantastical history that that would change the world.
We mustn't challenge. We mustn't come up with new theories. You give credence to the Māori, the so-called indigenous Māori, who are really indigenous to the other side of the Pacific and did well to get here, you say that that's okay, but people can't come from further away by the same means for some reason. I don't get into that, the Celtic stuff. I've read it. I've seen some books that are totally implausible, one called From the Ends of the Earth. It's just a ridiculous book. I think Martin would say so as well. Purporting that, this is a little speck, as it must be New Zealand, it could have been Fiji, it could have been the Philippines, same pictures repeated again and again and again, just nuts. So I can make the distinction between that and what Martin has explained to me. I would just like someone to debate him fairly, not with put downs, and I'll be interested in the result, and I'll be happy to assess it. But he has done an enormous amount of work, and all you want to do is say, oh, it can't be real because it would require...
Because it's a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Richard M. Nixon, when he was being exposed by Woodward and Bernstein over the Watergate affair, said, it's not true, they're just conspiracy theorists. He was later found out to be part of a conspiracy and a crook, which he also denied.
Of something being a conspiracy... you know, I've been to a 9/11 thing, a very plausible looking thing. I don't know, I'm bewildered. But I certainly know that they put up an awful lot of evidence, and they deserve to be respected, and they deserve to be negated. They deserve to be a two-sided debate on all these things. Not one person just saying, oh, it's too fantastic for me, I can't be bothered, I'm not going to listen, so I'll just call it a conspiracy theory, and that'll probably convince a number of people not to bother.
Not to mention, Joe, you made the point earlier that why would somebody spend their entire life devoted to a field of study just to mislead and deceive people? Mm. Which is precisely the exact same thing that Martin Dutre has done.
Well, no, it's not.
Well, not his entire life, but...
He doesn't have a history degree. He's never been through a university. He doesn't know how to tell the truth.
How to deceive. You know, the academia has a bloody lot to answer for. I don't think anybody buys the argument just because you've been to university and become a trained parrot that you are somehow more intelligent than somebody else. You know, plumbers that I associate with are brighter than a hell of a lot of the graduates. The graduates have just submitted themselves to indoctrination. Now, that to me is not – I didn't hang around long at university, and I went back to tell them that a few years ago. I don't think just because someone's been to an indoctrination palace like Waikato University that they have any more claim on intelligence than anybody else. Arguably the reverse. People who conduct their own studies, like Martin Dutre have, like I have, I think you can argue that they are probably more independent of mind, more open-minded than those that submit themselves to indoctrination into how to become a trained parrot, like those who go to New Zealand University. That's why New Zealand University's social science degrees are so poorly thought of, the worst in the OECD. It's because of this, you know, this indoctrination program around the treaty as much as anything else.
Hmm. What's your response to that, Joe?
Well, Martin Dutre is he's an American immigrant here to New Zealand. And I think what his theories are actually based on is Anglo-Saxon racial superiority. And what confounds him is he doesn't accept that Polynesians, who were only probably 2,000 to 3,000 kilometres away, that island hopped from the Cook Islands to the Kermadecs to New Zealand and already had a proven knowledge on celestial navigation and... These are technologies that the Celtics didn't have. And what Dutre's not trying to prove, he's not trying to prove that they managed to get the journey here. What direction did they come from? Because if you've ever noticed the Pacific Ocean, it's blocked off by two large continents, North and South America, and also Africa, and also Australia to some degree. So if you spent the 3 years travelling here at 2 to 3 kilometres, don't you think you'd probably want to stop at one of the other large continents that are between here and New Zealand? So I just, there's no other evidence of the travel coming out here. There's no, what you also have to have is what's called, Māori have a mongoloid bee skull, Celtics had a Caucasoid skull. There'll be some evidence lying around like pre-Tasman Caucasoid skull buried somewhere. So you know, seeing a couple of dints and a couple of rocks, Māori could have done that. They were perfectly capable.
So did Māori use bullhorns and worship sunrises and dig trenches to measure equinoxes and all of that kind of stuff? Because according to the many of the kaumātua that Dutre has spoken to, that the Māori did do that and were taught those skills by the Patu Pai Arahe.
Well, if you know the Easter Islands and you've ever seen the Moya statues out there, the Polynesian race were very capable at designing rock art or large statues.
Maybe you don't know just how capable, Joe. They were recently excavated around. You know how they're just the heads? They excavated, and they're not just heads, bro. They're all the way down.
Hell's teeth, really?
They're like 3-4 times as tall as anybody thought. So however, whatever methodology we think they managed to do that now, we're still amazing and we still can't explain it. Imagine it 10 times as technologically advanced. Not to mention, Maori and 186 other cultures around the world have stories of a great flood that wiped everything out. So if there was an ancient civilization here, it would have been wiped out.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go to a break. We'll be right back. Don't you go anywhere. And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Yep, civilization basically just got wiped out long ago, according to 187 cultures. What do you reckon?
See, Joe, why are you so sensitive to it? It doesn't matter how they got here anyway. There's various views. The question is, the thing is that the Komatua, in a time when they didn't have this sort of money grubbing going on and they could afford to be honest about their history, it's there in their histories. You know, even Ranganui Walker in his Struggle Without End book said that when the people got here, they were met by these other people and they fought them.
The surveyors, I think, because they were all on the top of the hills and stuff all the time.
Right through. Martin Dutre is such a racist that he went and lived with a whole lot of Maori people for quite some years when he was younger.
Sounds like a bad guy to me.
Racists don't do that. I don't think Hitler was living in a kibbutz, you know.
He wasn't going to synagogue, was he?
Not a racist. He is a genuine seeker after the truth. You're trying to smear him, and I detest that. You're thrashing around trying to come up with all sorts of nonsense. But, you know, the fact is there was this stone city in the Waipoua Forest. It sounds fantastic. This tribe is covering it up. There were all these bones, which the honest Maori back in those days said, they're not ours, these larger-than-life people. Tasman saw these giants. We have Maori with red hair. Where did that come from? Mm-hmm. These are the sort of things you've got to look at. The people, the evidence that's here, and not grasp for straws on how they might or might not have got here. They evidently did get here, or at least that should be able to be discussed without iwi closing down the discussion. Now, here's another chart. I think if you can see this.
Bring it up all the way.
Evidence.
Oh, no, back and up. Sorry, John. way back.
I can't see you, see? So I'm
pull it back towards you, mate. Keep going.
But this is evidence.
And
that
stop.
This is evidence that evidence of these pre-Maori excavations were embargoed until
2063.
Why would you do that if you had nothing to hide? Why would the state do that if it wasn't trying to cover it up? Why are there hundreds of sites around the country where this sort of stuff's been going on? I'm less interested in the facts of the matter. I don't understand the facts about the pre-Maori so much. But I'm interested in why the state and why the iwi want to cover it up so much.
It's funny you should mention that because just recently, John, I've been interviewing some guys who are researching into ancient American history. And it turns out, you know Wrigley's chewing gum, the Wrigley's family, not too long ago, I think back in the 1970s, they had a museum in Massachusetts where they had giant bones. And they were on display in all the cases and everything, and you can even purchase some at the gift shop from real giants.
You know, these questions have to be answered. They do sound fantastic. We should have the debate. Joe should be debating with Martin on this one. Let Martin have a say for 2 hours because he could talk for the whole time and it would be mind-boggling. The crew from Maori TV were tremendously impressed with what Martin was telling them. The journalist couldn't wait to cover it up, but she was pretty mind-boggled as well. Martin just kept making sense. That's the point. He keeps making sense. It's very hard to defeat him if you're not into the archaeology area. So we need to get an archaeologist to go up against him. Get the state's best archaeologist. He would be confident of explaining his position. Only when you get that would Joe probably be anywhere near convinced. He'd probably find some other way to denigrate Martin. But Martin would be very happy to go up against whoever the state says is their foremost archaeologist with the facts. as long as the other guy is going to respond with facts as well.
Mm. And I feel also we're both ganging up on Joe at this point. I'd like to allow you to respond, Joe, if you can.
Well, I can explain who Patapārihi are. They are Patapārihi are mystical creatures similar to leprechauns in Ireland. They're pale-skinned, and they're about 30 centimetres tall, the size of a smurf. What Dutry's done, is why Māori gets so insulted by this, is he's hijacked our history or a fairy tale we have, and he's trying to use it to undermine treaty settlements. And it's the sole purpose. If he can prove that Māori were here in New Zealand and colonised New Zealand after British Celtics, then some theory that he has is that this would undermine the treaty settlements, and because Māori were the interlopers.
No, he doesn't say that at all. It doesn't affect the treaty. Well, he might. I don't think he does.
I think his argument with the treaty is just the Littlewood Treaty. The ancient thing is just an archaeological interest to him.
Yeah, whoever might have been here before Māori, and it's the Kamatawa that told him, not, you know, you've got to argue with them that who the Patapārihi were, and he's got these evidence of people with red hair and so on and white skin. That's physical evidence. But, you know, it doesn't alter the fact that Māori were certainly the incumbents in 1840. Nobody's questioning that. It doesn't affect the treaty process whatsoever. It certainly affects the claim to indigeneity, but that is extinguished by Māori's own admission, quite proudly, that they are indigenous to the other side of the Pacific. You know, so I don't think the pre-Māori changes all that much. It makes things pretty interesting, and it certainly undermines the claim that, you know, we were here first. I don't think being here first has any bearing on anything anyway. I don't think that I'm more of a New Zealander because my first relatives came here in 1842 than my wife, who was an immigrant in 1993, any more than your Māori forebears might have come here in 1350. I think it's irrelevant what time we got here in a democracy where all people are supposed to be equal.
Hmm. Now, may I ask, Joe, what's more likely to you, that there was perhaps an ancient civilization that was passed, that maybe through oral tradition is now passed down and there's evidence for now, or that there's an oral tradition and evidence for blue smurfs, as you say?
That was
something that I found very interesting, because what happens through oral traditions is that things that used to be real become sort of, romanticized or fantasized or something like that, and the truth gets lost over time. I would say that that's probably a bit more likely than there actually being fairies that we just can't find now, but that's me. Joe?
Yeah, I think what Martin Dutre's done is he's just taken a fairy tale and he's ran away with it. It's like me saying that that Māori managed to, at the time of Christ, managed to colonise England, and King Arthur was actually Māori. And also saying that, what's that wizard that they used to have back then?
The Wizard of Oz? No?
Merlin?
Merlin. Well, that's like me saying that Merlin was a great Māori tohunga, and he actually came from the South Pacific and they had travelled all the way to England. And it's really offensive to British history. And if I started up an organisation that said that, Paul Moon, all of the national historians would call me out on it. They'd have issues with that type of history.
It's a good line, but, you know, what you've got that's highly inconvenient is that your elders say the same stuff as Martin. They told Martin this stuff. Now, until you deal with that one, you haven't got a coherent argument. Why does Māori history, why does David Rankin, who's a chief up in the north there, say that Te Tai Tokerau means on the tide from the Tokelau's, we just kind of drifted here, which must be even more offensive to you. And I'm not saying he's right. I'm just saying that he seems to think he is. So you've got strains, all sorts of strains of opinion here, there, and everywhere that we can adopt to suit our agenda if we want to.
Hmm.
Why bag a man who, you know, you're prepared to accept that James Bellich and Claudia Orange couldn't possibly spend their entire lives, you know, perpetuating a left-wing myth. But you are prepared to accept that Martin Dutre can spend a greater part of his life coming up with far-fetched accounts, which he seems to be able to talk about at great length, but nobody seems to want to hear it.
Hmm.
You're being selective.
Well, that might be because historians, professional historians and archaeologists, they use modern science when they investigate these things. Like, they use DNA testing.
Yes.
They also use carbon dating.
Yes.
So Martin Dutre, I don't see that he's done any DNA testing on...
Well, you've been paying attention, because there was a carbon dating done that dated something to do with a garden up in the Waipora city at something like 1700 BC. But, of course, that was shut down. Why are these things being shut down? You haven't responded to why these things, if they're so innocuous, are being locked away until everybody's dead. 2063. Why would you do that if it's all just nonsense?
Where was that document from, John, exactly?
Well, that was the work. I've got the original one here somewhere, but I probably won't find it in time. But it was a request for the carbon dating evidence that somebody overheard one of the archaeologists from the Crown mentioning, and that's the response that came back. There was a senior archaeologist who discovered this stuff, but they were all shut down. After the state discovered stuff they didn't really want to discover of this so-called stone city with all sorts of stone houses and walls and things like that that weren't particularly Maori in origin.
Yeah.
There's
hundreds of thousands of sites around the world that that point to an advanced civilization that was incredible at working with stones that had a global trade routes and things like that. All of it, the exact same thing happened, John. The exact same thing. All the testing's blocked, all the people get demonized, and it gets rejected out of the media, they get called names and all of that kind of stuff. And none of the people that are attacking them or arguing against them have ever even read it into their research. And if they have, they deny its existence in the first frickin' place.
I mean, it's utterly fascinating to everybody, but why aren't there documentaries about it with people on both sides going hammer and tongs? So that we at home can sort of figure out who's telling the truth or who isn't. But those documentaries aren't allowed to be made. Now, thanks to Māori TV, Martin and us bringing along a second camera, Martin is making a documentary about his tour on that day that wasn't shown, and the things that he said and footage that he has from other times. So they've been very helpful in making that happen. But why isn't it on the History Channel? Why isn't, they broadcast evidence for much less.
Mm. Well, I've put it on YouTube for Martin, and Martin's written a book and all of that. You've seen the thing on YouTube. You've read the book, haven't you, Joe?
What book's that?
I'll take that as a no.
It was called Celtic New Zealand, wasn't it? I haven't read it either, but I just know this guy. He's a mild-mannered guy. He's not a racist. He's a very thorough researcher, and he's able and willing to debate anybody, anytime, anywhere about anything.
Mm.
That, to me, suggests a pretty good either completely deluded sort of sociopath or something, or he's what he claims he is. I think he's what he claims he is, and I just wish, and I notice that nobody will debate him.
Mm.
And I notice the same thing on climate change, and that's what makes me...
Same thing on climate change, same thing on 9/11.
Why not stage the debate,
I mean, today, here, for example, here we are, gentlemen, we're having a genuine debate about a real issue that actually affects this country, and both sides are allowed to speak. Why is that not happening with all of these major issues in our country? I'll tell you why, because whoever's in control doesn't want them to. Now, it might be like a feeding frenzy where every shark has its own agenda, but they all have the same target.
I think it's called a democracy, and I thank you for the opportunity to have this debate. And I think, Joe, we agreed at halftime that we're both getting a fair shake. That's what you want in a democracy. If I stuff up, if I tell porkies and Joe can prove it, then that's bad for me, but I've had my chance. And that's all we want. We want a chance to put our view in the public to see both sides, and that should happen on everything.
Mm. Do you believe that to be true, Joe, even if you don't agree with what people's opinions are, that they should be able to at least say their piece?
Oh, most certainly. I'd like to get write a response to some of the comments that John's made. Well, the only history of I've read of New Zealand is the Penguin History of New Zealand by Michael King, and that's quite a credible source of history, and it says despite a plethora of conspiracy theories of Phoenicians and a whole lot of other civilizations. He makes it very clear the first civilization or the first people to make the shores of New Zealand are Polynesians. There's no one else. There's no
sure.
No other civilization. But also, I was John mentioned David Rankin as some Komatua. Well, he's not. David Rankin's actually no one within Ngāpuhi. He holds no ranking despite the. What he says is otherwise, but with the whole alternate history that Martin Dutre has portrayed, the New Zealand archaeology.
How much do you know about what he said, though? I mean, again, you haven't seen his presentation on YouTube or read his book, so you don't know what alternative history he's talking about, do you, Joe?
I have seen his YouTube clip.
But how long was it? Was it the hour and a half one where he does the full slide presentation?
No, it's got some funny music to it. But what I'm getting at is the New Zealand Archaeological Society have denied these alternate histories emphatically. They've said that all these entire histories are based on racism and nothing more.
And we will be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. It's the lighter side of genocide, because if you lose your sense of humour about things, you will go friggin' nuts. Back in a tick.